Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. H. John Benjamin is a comedian and actor, best known for voicing the title characters on Fox's Bob's Burgers.
And his name is Bob Burger.
What?
His name is Bob Burger.
It's not.
It is.
It isn't, no.
It's not?
No. Are you serious?
Bob Burgers. Bob Burgers. Then who am I thinking of?
I don't know.
But the sign.
Okay.
It's Bob Belcher. And FXX's Archer.
Is that sarcasm?
No, sir.
Oh, good. Because your opinion matters. And since you seem unclear on the concept, that was sarcasm.
His new attempted memoir, Failure is an Option, is a chronicle of defeats and losses beating a steady drum throughout his life. It begins with the inscription, "For all of you failures out there, you can do worse." He is, by all accounts, a pretty successful guy, the lead of two popular television shows. But he points out, voiceover only takes a few hours on any given workday, and often he fills the rest of his time with failing. And that's okay. John Benjamin, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
How's the table?
It's good. It's good. It's not round, and there isn't a round one in the building, so that's where we are.
Oh, my God. So it's finally revealed that this whole thing's a sham.
Right, we're huge liars.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is an idiom, I guess.
So you have this memoir out. How were you convinced to write the book? It does feel, as I'm reading it, like you didn't really...
I was forced into it.
Yeah, you didn't really want to do it.
There was an element of that. And I think there's definitely points in the book where I really did hit a wall and reached out to other people to try and help me write it. There's two occasions in the book where I reached out to professors to write the book or the remainder of the book for me.
Yeah, two professors named Andrew.
Yeah, both professors named Andrew, two different professors.
Mm-hmm.
So I did get a little material out of them because I published the email exchanges that we had about them not wanting to participate in the authorship of my book.
And seemingly being pretty confused about why you would ask them that.
Well, it is a confusing thing to ask published authors. They both were. So, they didn't want to share their work with me. They felt it would be unethical, and it was, but I did get what I could out of it, which was like maybe about 10 pages.
Did you have a word count or page minimum you had to reach?
There was. I think that was also part of the problem. I think early on in the writing process, I discovered I was at about like 12, 15,000, and then my book agent told me that I had to hit like 80 to 90. So I went into a tailspin. And I think that's when I started reaching out to other people to do it for me, which, you know, went in line with the premise of the book. I think it was like built in where I probably wouldn't be able to finish it. I mean, failure is an option.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I did. I pulled it through. I made it. It took a long time, but I did do it.
An early chapter in the book is entitled "How I Failed at Pretty Much Everything as a Kid," in parentheses, the foundations of failure. When you were a kid, did you feel in the moment of being a kid that you were a failure? Or looking back, do you think you were a failure of a kid?
I think it's a bit of both. I think at the time, although I can't put myself in the headspace of when I was like 8 or 9, but I definitely recall like kind of like being like kind of a reluctant visitor to everything I did. Like I didn't want to be in school. I didn't want to be at home. Sorry to depress you. But I was kind of like pulling myself through everything. I definitely recall, I think, that overarching feeling of like being an unwilling participant in my own life. Many would probably call that early onset depression. But I've kind of tried to use that as an advantage as I got through, and then I finally wrote the book. It was worth it for that.
Are you a willing participant in your life now? Do you sometimes feel like being some places?
I've gotten moderately better at it, and when I'm feeling that way, I think at least I put on a good face now.
When you were a teenager, you got into disco, very into disco for a little while, and wanted to theme your bar mitzvah party around disco, which no one around you almost was into along with you. How did you get into disco?
Well, I think it was popular at the time, but certainly not where I grew up.
Right.
I think there was, I would think predominantly it was rock and roll country in central Massachusetts, a lot of Bruce Springsteen, a lot of classic, like I guess what you would call classic rock, which is contemporary rock then.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother was a ballet dancer, so she didn't play disco, but like I guess I had the dance gene, and disco was dance music. So I spent a lot of time, I think, utilizing it for dancing alone in my room to disco, which I couldn't have looked good. But I could do the disco splits, because like I said, I did inherit some of her dance ability. So that was what I think, that was what initially got me into disco dancing. And then I learned to roller skate, which is a big part of the disco scene then. So I would go to roller rinks, and that's where disco was played. That was like the pre-club version, like junior disco.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was not the recommended type of music to listen to, because you'd often get beat up for it.
Oh, no.
That was a big part of me running away from kids who liked rock and roll. There was a lot of like kids chasing me because I liked disco.
But you did genuinely, like you loved it, right?
I did. I mean, I think I did. I spent like, certainly my, I feathered my hair. I was very like Tony Manero.
Later in the book, there's a chapter, Buying a Motorcycle and How I Failed to Ride It. And in that chapter, you tell a very funny story about buying, like the title says of the chapter, buying a motorcycle and never riding it. But you also tell us about, or the reader, about your first car. Could you tell me more about how you happen to have this pretty ostentatious wild car as your first car?
Yeah, for some reason, I think what happened was my father wanted that car, and he bought it for me so that he could use it. And it was a MG Midget, which is this little like British sports car, like convertible, that never worked. It always broke down. But I was I'd just gotten my license, and it was yellow, like bright yellow.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like this car that was like everybody was looking at, and I was like the last thing I wanted. So he saddled me with a car that was it ended up being a disaster for me for a couple of years. One, it always broke down, and the other side of it, everybody always pointed it out. And I wasn't that guy. Like I wasn't a guy having a midlife crisis at that point.
Right, you weren't going to pop the hood and like talk about the car.
Yeah, wear a driving cap and driving gloves and a tweed jacket. And I was 16 and I was like in the wrong car. He just should have bought me a Toyota.
Stories of failure are a part of everyone's life, and some of the stories in your book could be considered conventionally embarrassing. Are there any stories, and I'm not asking you to tell them now because you might have left them out of the book for any given number of reasons, but are there stories that occurred to you that you were like, I can't, like, you know, I'm not ready to joke about this. I'm not going to write about it, or I'm not going to share it with strangers because it is just too much.
Well, like certain stories about my family and my immediate family and my biological family. I've kept some of those stories at bay, but maybe someday I'll really expose them. But for this one, I sort of kind of focused on some of the more mundane failures in my life, just because that it made it a little less tragic.
You also have failed lists. There's different lists in the book: failed pickup lines, weed strains, presidential pets. Where did you get the idea to include these sort of fake funny failure lists and include them in the book?
Well, I guess that was a word count issue as well. We keep bringing it up. No, that's all right. I readily admit that I was coming up short again and again and again. But I mean, I think I had some ideas for just sort of break up the stories, the narrative stories and the personal history stories. So I'd sort of use that as a sort of interstitial elements, just to just as a fun thing. Mm-hmm. If you think it's fun, I hope so.
I think it's fun. I was just going to ask you if you did have any fun writing those.
Oh, no.
No.
No, none. No, I did. And I've told the story early on where I started writing this like a seasoned author might, in a very pretentious way. Like, I rented a cabin in the woods and left my family for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and ended up getting nothing done except for, like, you know, cooking and doing laundry by myself for 2 weeks, and came home with, I think, like 3 pages. So I'm no Stephen King.
As you are a little bit on the road, you've done a number of book events over the last few days, and mm-hmm. you have to talk about your, and so then you do the talk show circuit. There's a new season of Archer just started, and the book is out. You have to talk about yourself a lot. Are you tired of it? Do you want to talk about something else?
Yeah. Is this a segue into talking about something else?
I don't have an idea of what else we would discuss, because I'm pretty excited to talk about you, but...
Oh, you know, I'm not like, I was just telling my friend last night that we got through, I'm fine like doing the live events and performing, but I'm a kind of reluctant talker, so as you can tell, I do a lot of stammering and pausing. It's very much like the character Bob I play.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a little tough, but... And it's always like, I feel like I have to talk more about the book, but I don't have much more to say except for enjoy it.
On the book events you did over the last few days, Eugene Merman went on the road with you to sort of, I guess you guys did a kind of like in conversation series as you talked about the
book. Yeah, that helped to have him, because we're friends and we've done a lot of comedy together, obviously. And those were good in that he never talked about the book. Like, he just decided to ignore it entirely. So we would just have 1 hour discursive conversations on stage, and I think people were completely flummoxed. Like, what about the book?
You think so?
Well, I think people enjoyed it, but, like, it was funny that he would basically avoid the topic entirely. So that worked out well, and that was fun to do.
I saw a Bob's Burgers live at the Beacon Theater in New York a few years ago, and you also do those like tours. You and the voice casts and the show creators have done that with Archer as well, which I haven't ever caught, but I know you guys do that too.
Right. They just do like, yeah, commonly they've done, both of the shows have done like live script readings, perform a show live, like read a script live.
And is it must be very, very different from the way you obviously normally record the show. Do you like going out and getting together with everybody and doing the live events?
Well, I think the fans really like it. Like, both shows have a really hardcore fan base. So, yeah, that's always good to perform for them live. I always thought it would be kind of the inverse, where people wouldn't appreciate, like, seeing the people behind. You kind of prefer that world stays like as it is, as in always animated, and then you have to see these people talking. Sometimes it's confusing, the people behind the characters. But they usually go really well, just because there's so many fans of the show that want to come out and support it. So those are fun to do.
I have a specific thing that I always like scream laugh or just love on Bob's Burgers, where, I mean, lots of things. I love the show. But one thing is sometimes when the character of Linda, who plays your character's wife, Linda's voiced by John Roberts, when she's being, I mean, she's often quite over the top. She's a very emotional, enthusiastic person character. She will,
yes.
She will be like really, really wild and completely ridiculous. And Bob, your character, Bob, kind of quietly laughs at her instead of, like, he'll be exasperated, but he'll also laugh. And I thought to myself, if I ever get to talk to John Benjamin, I'm going to ask him if it's written that he laughs or if he just is laughing at how insane his co-star is being.
Well, John is kind of like that in real life. So, I mean, he does put on a voice for Linda, but he's also like kind of has that personality. He's very. So I think we have like the two of us kind of even out of character are more like Linda and Bob in real life now. So we're kind of like one organism. So I respond to him as Bob and as me pretty much the same way, which is a lot of like kind of cautious bemusement. sometimes like I Bob makes a lot of like also kind of aggrieved noises because of Linda's behavior. So I do a lot of that to John in real life too. Like, I think Bob is like always kind of like feels like he's in a hostage crisis.
Yeah, it does seem that way. Do you watch Bob's Burgers or Archer?
I do. I watch both shows. My kid, who's now 15, has kind of brought me along where he watches a lot of Archer now, and earlier when he was a little younger, watched a lot of Bob's Burgers. So, yeah, he has to hear, like, he really has to hear me a lot.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't have to watch the show, but he...
He doesn't, and he does. He likes both shows, mm-hmm. but I think the one element he just wants to end is me talking.
You're the title character of both shows. Like,
I know,
he's just gonna have
like,
to deal
I'm
with
the
it.
Title character in his life, in his real life, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the title character, but I'm like really prominent in the story of his life. I think he just wants me to stop talking.
One more thing before I let you go. You were recently on an episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver in a sketch that they wrote about how ridiculous the immigration court can be. And it was a send-up of a court TV show called Tot Bench, where everybody except the defendant was 3 or 4 years old. And you were a defendant in the courtroom scene.
How did you become a judge?
I believed in myself to be a judge.
How long have you been doing this?
14 years.
You've been doing this for 14 years, but you're four?
Yeah.
So you had to act with a room full of kids. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
How did you feel about it as it was happening?
It was a little grueling. It wasn't that bad, though. They handled it pretty well. But the kids were like, well, some of them are like prelingual or semilingual. But some kids were like incredible. It sort of ran the gamut. Like a couple kids like, you know, had to deliver a line, but they wouldn't like sit in the chair. So there was a lot of like, you know, like running around and kicking a ball. And I had to sort of run in when finally a kid was like lulled into sitting for like 7 seconds, just so I could run in and like do my line, and then the kid would run off. So it took a little time, but they were pretty good. And a lot of them were like literally the kids of the staff of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So. And then there were a couple like professionals who carried most of the lines, but it was still definitely, it took like 3 or 4 hours for a 1 minute skit.
Yeah. Well, it was very funny. So thank you for doing it.
No. I've been in a few, bits with John and his show, and I'm always happy to do it.
Failure is an Option, an Attempted Memoir by H. John Benjamin, is available from Dutton. It's been an enormous thrill for me to get to speak with you. Thank you so much.
No, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
H. John Benjamin's memoir, Failure is an Option, is available now from Dutton Books.
Would you say we'd be venturing into a zone of danger?